am quite obviously not Alan Shapiro, but as his student at Johns Hopkins University, I am delighted and honored to present his paper for him, entitled Athenian Identity and the Eastern Other from Croesus to Xerxes. Perhaps the earliest statement of Greek identity in the classical period is contained in an often cited passage of Herodotus, Book 8, Chapter 144. I quote a few sentences from the Athenian speech, "For there are many great reasons we should not do this, i.e., surrender, even if we so desired. First and foremost, the burning and destruction of the adornments and temples of our gods, whom we are constrained to avenge to the utmost. And next, the kinship of all Greeks in blood and speech, and the shrines of gods and sacrifices that we have in common, and the similarity of our way of life." Some of the key terms in the Greek are homaimon, common blood, homoglosson, common language, theon, hydrumata, tikhoina, kaithousiai, shrines of the gods and sacrifices in common, and etheia homotropa, common ways of doing things. As an archaeologist and a student of Greek vase painting, I have asked myself how these concepts might have been visualized by a Greek artist at the time of the Persian Wars. I offer for your consideration a magnificent Attic red figure cup that is now in the Villa Julia. It was previously in the J. Paul Getty Museum in California for some 15 years before being returned to the Republic of Italy in 1998. The cup is extraordinarily large, with a diameter of 46.5 centimeters, placing it in a small category known as parade cups because they were clearly made for display rather than for ordinary use. It carries the signature of Euphronius as potter and has been attributed to the painter Onesimos. According to Geoffrey Williams of the British Museum, it is the masterpiece of the painter's early middle phase, which he dates to 500 to 490 BC. The interior is devoted to a panoramic scene of the sack of Troy. I am not claiming that the Trojans are here presented as the Eastern barbarian or other. That equation will arise in Athens only after the final defeat of the Persians in 479. We see it, for example, in Aeschylus's Agamemnon, where Priam is described as an Eastern potentate in the famous carpet scene. Rather, the Trojans are imagined here as sharing all the criteria of identity with the Greeks. This is fully in keeping with the world of the Iliad, in which Trojans and Greeks speak the same language, worship the same gods with the same rituals and practices, and observe the same customs, such as Xenia. There are even Greeks and Trojans who share a common descent. Instead, what the cup shows is a contrast between Greeks acting in accordance with the norms of Greek identity and behavior, and those who violate those norms and thus, in a sense, lose their Greek identity and act like barbarians. The key criterion for acting like a barbarian is the one alluded to by the Athenian spokesman in Herodotus, cited above, when he recalls the Persians violating and destroying the sanctuaries and temples of the gods. The eye of the viewer immediately falls on the two most egregious examples of Greeks behaving like barbarians. In the central medallion, Neoptolemus, the son of Achilles, murders both Priam and his grandson Astyanax, whose small naked body here, he swings by one foot. The woman in the background, with both hands raised to her head, in a gesture of distraught mourning, is labeled as Polyxena, since she herself is fated soon to be sacrificed to appease the ghost of Achilles. Yet another act of barbarity is alluded to in her presence. Directly above, here, in the outer zone, the lesser Ajax prepares to rape the nearly naked and defenseless Trojan princess Cassandra as she clings to the statue of Athena. The barbarism of these two brutal acts derives not simply from the violence itself. In wartime, old men and young children are always vulnerable, and women are always the victim of rape, but from the fact that they take place in sacred space, in sanctuaries of the gods. Athena's statue marks the goddess's domain, and the large bronze tripod alongside the statue is a reference to dedications made in sanctuaries. Priam's death takes place at an altar, right here, and just to drive home the point with bitter irony, this altar is labeled as that of Zeus Hercaeus, that is, Zeus as the god who protects suppliants. The punishments for these acts of impiety were well known to the epic tradition. Neoptolemus would be struck down at the altar of Apollo at Delphi, and Ajax condemned by the Greeks themselves for his rape of Cassandra and drowned in a storm sent by Athena. Yet these horrific deeds are juxtaposed in the cup with those of other heroes who display the positive side of what it meant to be a Greek. At 9 o'clock in the outer zone, over here, a white-haired old woman reaches out her arms to two young warriors. Aethra, the mother of the Athenian hero Theseus, rescued by her grandsons, Acamas and Demophon. Aethra had ended up in Troy as a captive and handmaiden of Helen. Her son Theseus did not come to Troy because he belonged to an older generation of heroes, but his two sons arrived just in time for the last days of the war. In the larger context of Onesimus's cup, this family reunion embodies the first criterion of Greek identity, blood and kinship, homoimon, and enunciates the principle of family loyalty and pietas. On the opposite side of the interior, at 3 o'clock, here, the old woman performs a similar gesture of reaching out her hands in supplication of a warrior. She is Theano, princess of Athena at Troy, and husband of Antenor, who is also shown. This little-known episode from the sack of Troy illustrates one of the most fundamental principles of the Greek way of life, xenia, or hospitality to strangers. Years earlier, Odysseus had come to Troy, along with Menelaus, to try to negotiate Helen's safe return and thus prevent a war. The mission itself was a failure, but the hospitality of Theano and Antenor was not forgotten, and here it is Odysseus to whom Theano turns to protection amid the tumult of the sack of her city. He will oblige, ensuring that both Antenor and his wife are spared. Perhaps it was in part this noble deed that ensured that Odysseus, unlike the lesser Ajax and Neoptolemus, would enjoy a successful, if very belated, homecoming to Ithaca. Thus far, we have seen that two of the criteria for Greek identity, blood and shared customs, homaima and etheia homotropa, are illustrated by Onesimus. The third, common shrines and sacrifices, is also present, but thus far only in the negative exemplar of being violated. The fact that these shrines are in a foreign and hostile city is irrelevant, since the gods are the same everywhere. The only criterion of identity that does not seem at first to play a role on the Onesimus cup is that of language, other than the inscriptions labeling many of the figures. Though here too, the vase has a surprise in store. The Etruscan owner scratched on the bottom of the vase, underside the foot, a dedication in his own language before offering it at a shrine of Hercle, the Etruscan Heracles at Cerveteri. The implications of this for looking at Greek identity in a non-Greek context could be the subject of another paper. What of the other episodes on the fragmentary interior of the cup? Just behind Aethra, a Trojan woman uses a long pestle to try to defend herself against a Greek soldier armed with a makaira, or long curved sword. The scene illustrates an aspect of Greek identity that Herodotus does not explicitly state, but is deeply embedded in the epic tradition. A woman of noble character is capable of acts of heroism that transcend the limitations of her sex. On other vases of the period, the woman wielding the pestle is Andromache, the wife of Hector, who served as the model of the loyal, brave, and devoted wife and mother. The nobility of Andromache was remembered in later times, most notably in Euripides' play named for her, in which she is a foreign captive, yet her dignity far outshines the pettiness of the Greek Hermione, daughter of Helen, against whom she is pitted in the drama. This is Euripides' way of exploring the myth of the enslaved Trojan barbarian versus the noble Greek, and of showing that the personal integrity wins out in the end. At the bottom of the clock, 6 o'clock, we find depicted for the first time in Greek art an episode that will have great resonance later in the classical period and beyond, Menelaus threatening to kill his wayward wife Helen, but dropping his sword at the last moment, overcome by her beauty. The goddess Aphrodite may have appeared behind Helen, tugging at her garment, which would account for the awkward pose as she reaches out her hands in supplication. Eros, as Aphrodite's helper, hovers between Helen and Menelaus. He may have even been pouring a love potion to bewitch the enraged husband, as we see on a later vase. This encounter took place in a sanctuary as well, namely that of Athena, to which Helen had fled for protection. But unlike Cassandra and Priam, she does find the safety that she seeks, and Menelaus, whether of his own accord or not, does in the end respect the sanctity of the goddess's shrine. In return, like Odysseus, and unlike the impious Neoptolemus and Ajax, he will be rewarded with a successful homecoming to Sparta. This is part of Greek identity as well, the recognition that, in the end, everything is in the hands of the Olympian gods. The dating of this cup to the 490s places it in the period of the Ionian Revolt, when the theme of the destruction of cities and shrines was very much in the air. The burning of Sardis, capital of a Persian satrapy, by the Greeks, and 5 years later, in 494, the sack of Miletus by the Persians in retaliation. The destruction of Sardis will, in turn, have called to mind the figure of Croesus, king of Lydia, who ruled at Sardis until his defeat by the Persian Cyrus in 546. This is no doubt why the painter Myson, an Athenian and contemporary of Onesimus, revived the legend of Croesus' death on the pyre, on his famous amphora now in the Louvre, at the moment of the Ionian Revolt. In the legend, told later by Bacchylides and Herodotus, Croesus was spared at the last minute by the god Apollo, partly in appreciation of the lavish offerings he had made in the god's sanctuary at Delphi. We see once again that the Greek identity in the archaic period is a much more fluid thing than it will become, and can encompass even foreigners who share in the values and customs, ethia, homotropa, of the Greeks. I end with an astonishing and unique vase, a relatively recent find that adds a new dimension to the themes discussed here. This large red figure fiale, a translation into clay of a metal libation bowl, like the one Croesus holds, here, was made in Athens about 490, and according to Defree Williams, decorated by Onesimus, the painter of the cup with which we began. Like that one, it is now in the Villa Julia, having been excavated in the Etruscan sanctuary at Pyrgi. The decorative program, inside and out, offers a commentary of a different sort on the Greek values and the Greek way of life. The interior presents a symposium, or all-male drinking party, the quintessential institution that defines elite Greek identity in the late Archaic period. The interior, which I show in a more legible drawing, has at first glance another symposium. But with closer study, the excavator of the vase, Paolo Baglioni, recognized the scene as a mythological one, the slaughter of the suitors in the house of Odysseus. The best clue is the decapitated head at about 8 o'clock, right down here, rolling under a couch, identified as that of the soothsayer Leodes, still speaking. In other words, a perverted version of the symposium, in which the suitors had violated all the laws of Xenia and are ultimately punished for it. I end with a question. Is it possible that the story of the unwanted suitors taking up residence in the house of Odysseus and of their barbaric behavior once there was seen as a mythical analogy for the steady encroachment of the Persians into the homeland of the Greeks? This was surely the message of a wall painting by Polygnotus, showing Odysseus after he killed the suitors, commissioned for the temple of Athena Araya at Plataea. That temple was said to be a victory monument for the Battle of Marathon, and it stood at the site of the last great land victory over the Persians in 479. The fiale from Pyrgi invites us to consider the possibility that, more than a decade before Plataea, the story of the suitors was already understood in this light. It is tempting to think that, just as Onesimus drew on the part of the epic cycle that dealt with the fate of Troy to decorate his parade cup, so he turned slightly later to one of its sequels, The Homecoming of Odysseus. With both, he proved that the collective wisdom about what it means to be a Greek, and what it means to behave like a true Greek, that is contained in the Homeric epics, continued to form the basis of the Greeks' understanding of themselves throughout the rest of antiquity. Thank you.